This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The fentanyl mess. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Fentanyl can not only kill traditional users, but it also has secondhand dangers, especially for those in charge of cleaning up spills.
The food's banned in Europe, but not in the U.S.
Where you can earn $130,000 a year as an innkeeper.
Alabama versus Clemson Monday night for the college football national championship. The Crimson Tide's one weakness, its kicking game.
I think this issue is probably driving him crazy over his 12-year but it's a very difficult thing. You know, there are relatively few kickers in high school, so the talent pool is smaller to begin with. And one of the things I found that really is unusual to Alabama is because they're so excellent at everything else, a lot of the fan frustration really concentrates on this position.
Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman talks Alabama football in about 20 minutes. Of the roughly 70,000 overdose deaths in the United States in 2017, more than 29,000 were linked to fentanyl and other dangerous synthetic drugs. That's an 850% jump since 2013. Fentanyl-fueled opioid deaths are moving out of private homes and into public spaces now, which means the risk of secondary exposure is skyrocketing as well, especially for those who have to clean it up or come into contact with it unknowingly. More from Jeff Mordock, Justice Department reporter at the Washington Times. Jeff, what have you found?
This is absolutely fascinating, Gordon. One of the big problems with the opioid crisis is we're starting to see users use a lot more fentanyl, and fentanyl is extremely deadly. If you absorb it in your skin, if you inhale it, if it goes up your nostrils, you could die instantly. And it's a cheaper, more addictive high. So we're seeing more and more opioid users use it. But the problem is it also leaves a very deadly mess, and it's very expensive to clean up. It costs between $30,000 and $50,000 to clean up. Insurance companies don't want to pay for it. Homeowners are not required to disclose it if fentanyl spilled. So it's this threat that nobody seems to be taking charge of.
Wow. All right, so you, that $30,000 number that you mentioned came to mind, almost fell off my chair. This was the price that was quoted to actually clean up a car where some of this stuff spilled during a drug bust, right?
That's exactly right. There was a rental car in St. Louis. This is what I had uncovered, where the police had opened a bag of heroin. Fentanyl spilled out in the trunk. They contacted a remediation company to clean, which specializes in hazardous chemicals, to clean it up. $30,000, which, by the way, is the low end of the price. Wow. It usually can go as high as $50,000. Quoted $30,000 to clean it up. The rental company balked because their risk management lawyer said, we'd rather take the risk of a lawsuit because we think that's unlikely to happen rather than pay the $30,000 to clean it up. So now that car goes out, and the next person who rents it, who may have kids, may have a family, has no idea that fentanyl was all over the back of that trunk. And fentanyl looks like sand. So somebody could be running that car, see it, and think, oh, whoever had this car before me just went to the beach. Sure. And not realize how deadly that is.
I mean, how many fistfuls of sand did you eat as a kid growing up if you were at the beach, right? I mean,
exactly.
Oh, my goodness. And the rental car company in this case has no obligation legally.
There's no legal obligation. There's no federal law requiring anybody to clean up fentanyl. There's no requirements, and there's no protocol. I was talking to a police officer who was telling me they cleaned up a heroin overdose in a very nice hotel in Massachusetts, and it's not the type of hotel you would associate with opioid addiction. And he was telling me that they told the hotel, you need to bring somebody here to clean it up. And the hotel said, no, our maids will take care of it. Huh. And they said, no, you don't emphasize how important this is. And the hotel kept saying, our maids got it, because there's no protocol for cleaning this up.
We're speaking with Jeff Mordock, Washington Times Department of Justice reporter. His piece is called Fentanyl Leaves a Lethal Mess. that's costly to clean up. So you mentioned a hotel. You got these rental cars and other public spaces too, right? We're seeing this stuff move into libraries, as you point out, restaurants. I mean,
fast food bathrooms. Yeah. There's a lot of overdoses in fast food bathrooms. Libraries are, because they're places where you can go into, you don't have to pay to go into them, and it's a public space. So that's where people are ODing, and there's no policy to clean up. And the amount of fentanyl that police are finding when they arrest people are stunning. Last month, in November, in Maryland, there was a gentleman the state police pulled over, had 20 kilograms of fentanyl. 20 kilograms of fentanyl is enough to kill 1.5 times the population of the state of Maryland.
So what about some sort of protocol in the works? Are there any legislatures discussing this?
Right now, there are not. And it's interesting because when people were cooking meth in their house, there was a big wave of state legislatures. And I talked to a state legislator in Indiana, who was at the forefront of meth laws requiring homeowners to disclose that at one point their house was used to cook meth. But there's no disclosure law with fentanyl. And we can't retroactively apply meth laws to fentanyl because meth laws are so specific. Okay. They're going to require new laws, and we're already spending so much money fighting the opioids. We're already trying to pass so many laws. Earlier this year, I think Congress passed 50 laws dealing with the opioid crisis, yet none of those laws dealt with fentanyl cleanup, that I think this is getting ignored, and it's a very silent threat.
Wow. So I'm guessing it's simple as not just hosing it down. What's actually required to clean up fentanyl?
Well, what you need to do is you need to quarantine the entire area, and you need a specialized vacuum. And that is one of the reasons why it is so expensive, because most likely you're going to need more than one vacuum. And those vacuums sell for about $1,200. And you have to throw that vacuum away. So now the remediation companies then now have to buy a new vacuum.
Thanks, Jeff. Jeff Mordock, Justice Department reporter at The Washington Times. 13 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Time now for a business update. And it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Learn about the best state to start or grow your business at michiganbusiness.org. The European Union prohibits many food additives and various drugs that are widely used in American foods. Yet we still snatch that loaf of bread off the grocery store shelf, even though many of the ingredients we can't pronounce or have no idea what they are. More from Ronnie Rabin, health writer at the New York Times. Ronnie, take us through this.
Well, actually, lists like this have been circulating online in different publications for a while. We got this as a question from a reader. We know Europe is more conservative, shall we say, or more adheres to what's called the precautionary principle, which is if we're not sure, we'd rather not have it in our food. But these, all of the things that I'm looking at, several of them are additives that we actually know cause cancer, at least in animals. And our food laws say that you can't approve any additives that are known to cause cancer in animals or humans. So in other words, even if we don't have the full evidence on humans, they really shouldn't be in our food. But some of them have been in use for so long that the FDA has still allows them based on a sort of historic precedence there. And people will hear grass generally recognized as safe, things that we've been eating for so long that people assume they're safe. We do have evidence for some of these that they're not safe.
My goodness. Does that mean, like, in certain cases, it's below a certain danger level? Like, are there some semantics involved here?
Well, the FDA has restrictions on some of these. They're supposed to be used in a certain way. They've worked with bakers, for example, to make sure that that the way they use the two ingredients in dough, ADA and potassium bromate, that they will not be dangerous, that they'll be under certain levels, that they'll bake it in a certain way. But for the purists might think that even at a low level, why have a cancer-causing ingredient in food? These two things aren't required to make bread. You can make bread perfectly well without potassium bromate and ADA. It just makes the dough rise more, or look white, or look prettier, or be. They're dough conditioners. They make them maybe feel different or look different. They're not required for making bread.
Goodness. So some of this stuff is shelf life or to pretty things up? Is that what a lot of these things
are? Well, there are various things. I mean, there were some preservatives, BHA and BHT, Those are preservatives used in food. They are listed on labels. If you buy things at the supermarket, you will see them on the label, and that's one thing the FDA points out. You as a consumer can look and decide not to buy things that have them. They do extend the shelf life. Absolutely. Food coloring, again, makes things prettier. They may not even be used in foods that are green and yellow and blue. They're used in other foods. But again, they usually are listed. They should be listed. You can use things without them. And consumer pressure is tremendously powerful because when a food blogger started writing about potassium bromate and ADA a few years ago, several chains stopped using them. So there's nothing like consumer pressure. If people don't buy things, they won't sell. If people communicate to chain restaurants, especially where you don't know what's in your bun or your burger, that is incredibly powerful.
We're speaking with Ronnie Rabin, health writer at the New York Times. She's got a piece called What Foods Are Banned in Europe but Not Banned in the U.S.? She's responding to a reader question. So you referenced that the BVO, the brominated vegetable oil that's in citrus-flavored soft drinks. Like, what does it do, or what's the danger, I guess? What's been reported about it?
It's a little more nebulous on that because it contains an ingredient that's part of flame retardants. It's just something that I'm not sure exactly what the health. There are some health effects that have been seen with it. It's not as closely linked to cancer as some of the other things, but certainly there have been some studies finding ill effects from it.
Thanks, Ronnie. Ronnie Rabin, health writer at the New York Times. It is 21 minutes now after the hour. On this weekend, Alabama has won 5 national championships in the past 9 seasons. They face Clemson in the national championship game Monday night in pursuit of another title. The Crimson Tide are unbeaten, just landed the nation's top recruiting class, and have won 88% of its games in 12 years under head coach Nick Saban. What's the weak spot? Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
As Alabama gears up to try to win its 6th national football title in 10 years, it may have only one flaw: kickers who are below average. Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal has delved into this mystery and has more. Rachel, with a Crimson Tide consistently head and shoulders above everyone else in the world of college football, why are they having any kicking woes?
Well, that's a great question because, you know, they have excellent players at every other position. But one of the issues is that it's difficult to develop kickers everywhere in college football. There are limits to the number of coaches you can have, so most teams don't have a kicking coach, per se. Of course, there's roster limits, so you can't have, 5 kickers on the roster, generally, to have backups ready if one isn't up to snuff. And then there are some things that are unique to Alabama that I found in my research, or at least unusual to Alabama, that I think are having an effect as well.
Does Coach Nick Saban not emphasize kickers?
Oh, I think he does. I think this issue is probably driving him crazy over his 12-year stint at Alabama. But it's a very difficult thing. You know, there are relatively few kickers in high school, so the talent pool is smaller to begin with. And one of the things I found that really is unusual to Alabama is because they're so excellent at everything else, a lot of the fan frustration really concentrates on this position. So when a kicker messes up, which is not terribly unusual at Alabama, the backlash tends to be really extreme at Alabama in particular. And of course, their fans are legion and are famous for their devotion in general. And so when something is bothering them, they definitely make it known, in some cases through, issuing threats or, really nasty messages on social media when someone, for instance, has missed a kick.
But Rachel, is that really unique to Alabama? People are getting so nasty on social media.
Well, that's a great question. It's not unique to Alabama that there is backlash and there's terrible behavior on social media. I do think that it's possibly at a different level at Alabama because there really is very little other place to concentrate fans' frustration. As I said, they're undefeated this year. They've won 5 national titles in 9 years. They really don't mess up in many other areas. And so this is the one bugaboo that has really dogged them. And kickers have made mistakes in very high-profile games, which also, I think, sort of like exacerbates the fan reaction.
We're speaking with Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal. Rachel, I know you reached out to some of those kickers who have messed up in the past, and they didn't even want to talk to you, right?
Yes, a few wouldn't talk, and I certainly understand that. I think some of them maybe just want to avoid the fan backlash that I mentioned. The ones who did speak to me, you know, they had some really interesting insights. And one of the ones that I really hadn't heard elsewhere is Nick Saban's choice of a holder, you know, the person who takes the snap and actually holds the ball for the kick. Saban really prefers quarterbacks to do this, to add this to their duties. But a few kickers I talked to said that may not be the best idea because in practice, quarterbacks really have to spend most of their time, of course, running the offense, learning plays, honing them, perfecting them. So they don't have much time to spend practicing holding with the kickers. And as a result, these players said, they think that some of these kickers might be uncomfortable once they get in the game or just not have the rapport and you know, the level of ease that you might have if you spent most of your practice time with the same holder.
And to break that down a little further, it's not just a quarterback, but the starting quarterback. That makes a huge difference.
Yeah, Tua Tagovailoa started out, he held some last season and he held some for about half of the season. He's not doing most of the holds now, but a backup quarterback is. But, you know, even the backup quarterbacks spend most of their time in practice on the offense. They're still not spending their time with the kickers practicing holds most of the time. And so certainly it was kind of an extreme situation when you start the season with a Heisman Trophy candidate quarterback holding on kicks and extra points. But they still have a situation where the holder really doesn't spend most of his practice time with the kicker.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. Alabama and Clemson Monday night, 8 o'clock on ESPN. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
There's nothing small about your business. Your passion, your hours, your reputation, it's all huge. Your partnerships, even bigger. With Dell Small Business Technology Advisors, you'll get the tech, advice, and one-on-one partnership to help your business grow. Because with reliable Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, you can focus on what matters most, getting business done. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
Hey, thanks for spending part of your first full weekend of January with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenko coming up this half hour. The most important financial ideas. Also, which farmer's almanac do you trust when it comes to winter forecasts? And where you can earn $130,000 a year as an innkeeper? We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. It's the time of year where many of us make New Year's resolutions, but perhaps we should rethink that. According to Business Insider, 80% of us will break our New Year's resolutions by the second week of February. So why is this? How can we set achievable New Year's resolutions? And then what can we do to keep them? We're joined now by Lee Richardson, licensed professional counselor and founder of the Brain Performance Center in Dallas. Lee, what should we know?
Well, you know, I think every year we just start off hoping. One night we make these resolutions and we start off just hoping that things are going to go our way. And they don't, you know. When you think about it, if you keep doing the same old, the same old thoughts, the same old emotions, the same old beliefs, what are you going to get? Yeah. The same old. So I think, you know, if you have to feed your mind. You've got to put some new ideas in there. Get a new perspective. And I really don't care how positive you are. I don't care how enthusiastic you are. It's not going to happen if you don't have the right perspective.
Meaning what exactly?
Well, meaning that you think you can do it. You know, a lot of times when we talk about our New Year's resolutions, I should. That's very non-committal language. You know, how about I will? I will learn how to do this, you know, and believing that you can. I think that one of the things I suggest is find a great role model. Look around you. Who's getting the results that you want? And because change is hard. And if you don't surround yourself with people that believe in your ability and that you can model off of, it's gonna be a lot harder for you to make that change.
Is it best just to stick to, say, one resolution?
Oh, I definitely think so. I think when you pull out your laundry list, it's like, okay, which one do I want to work on today? You know? So that's, I think the main reason people don't make them is they're not realistic or they're very vague, or the timing's wrong. They really haven't thought about how they're going to approach it and how to set themselves up for success. And really, before you make those resolutions, get things kind of cleaned up. You know, if you're going to get more organized at your on your job, empty your inbox. Set up a better file system in your email. So think about how you can set yourself up to be successful, because failure is a pretty harsh word.
Yeah. Why is it that we make resolutions?
Well, I think that we, at the end of the year, it's a new year, we're hopeful. We feel like we should. We feel like that we should, you know, put ourselves in a better place. And we don't stop and think about, we're thinking about what we should do. We're not thinking about why we should do it.
Yeah. We're speaking with Lee Richardson, founder and clinical director of the Brain Performance Center. We're talking about how to keep your New Year's resolutions. I've heard anything from, you know, maintain this or these new habits for 3 to 6 weeks and you'll be well on your way to getting, say, past March and making this a good or sustained habit. Is that a fair number, or is there a number you use?
Well, I've heard the statistics I've seen is that the 80% of the people don't make them by mid-February. They're out. And I think the reason they don't is that they've got this big internal battle going on within themselves. You know, I want to do what I want to do, not what I should do. And just stop overthinking about how awful it's going to be if you have to eat that dry salad for dinner and go to the gym. Because if you stop those negative thoughts, you're going to have a much better chance of doing it.
Thanks, Lee. Lee Richardson, licensed professional counselor, also founder of the Brain Performance Center in Dallas. It is 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Welcome aboard. Thanks for being with us. What do you consider to be the important financial ideas? No doubt we'd all come up with a different list, sometimes radically different. And what we deem important likely says a lot about how we handle our money. Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com, has a handful of ideas that he considers important, and they influence how he manages his own money. Jonathan set this up.
So what I sat down to do for this piece was think about what were the most important financial ideas. Of course, everybody will have a slightly different list, but I pulled together 7 that I consider to be absolutely crucial to prudent money management.
All right, and the first one you go into right out of the gate, compounding.
I love compounding. I mean, compounding is the way that money grows and can grow exponentially over a time. It's the reason why when you're in your 20s, you should sock away as much money as you can, because ahead of you lies, you know, 40 years before you retire. And those small sums you put away, it may seem like a drop in the bucket, but left to grow, they can become huge sums by retirement. But you also need to think about compounding in reverse. And what I mean by that is when you go into debt, the interest that you're charged also compounds. One of the examples I pulled together for this piece was that if you racked up $5,000 in credit card debt while you were in college, and you were charged 20% interest on that debt, and you never made any payment on the credit card balance, which, of course, a credit card company wouldn't allow you to do, but if you never made a payment, after 40 years, you would owe the credit card company $7.3 million.
Wow. I had never considered that. No wonder they wouldn't let it go that far. Man.
Yeah, but they still want their 20%.
That's right. Point number 2, you mentioned opportunity cost, and what jumped out at me was the fact that you might spend $1,000 on something that makes you feel good now, but that could cost you $4,000 in retirement.
Absolutely. You know, we make these impulsive spending decisions all the time, and yet we don't consider the alternatives. And the alternatives might be to buy something else instead of whatever we walk out of the store with, or alternatively, it might be the opportunity to buy something later. And if we buy it later, i.e. we save the money and we leave it to grow, we'll have the chance to buy far more. So as you mentioned, if you have $1,000 that you're thinking about spending today, and instead you put it into the market and left it to grow, after 30 years, you might have $4,000 to spend.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. What was point number 5 about risk pooling?
So when we buy insurance policies, what we're essentially doing is we're throwing our dollars into a pool of money that's overseen by the insurance company. Those people who have something bad happen to them get paid out of the insurance pool, and those of us who get through the year unscathed don't get anything. You know, with most insurance policies, your hope should be to pay your premiums every year and get nothing in return, because if that's happening, that means that life is good.
Mm. I like the one, too, where you mention ownership, because nobody ever got rich from renting. Explain what you meant there.
Sure. We have this choice between owning and renting in numerous financial situations. Obviously, when it comes to a house, you know, we have this choice to own a house or to rent it. Similarly, you know, we have that choice when it comes to cars. We can either buy a car or we can lease it. But it also occurs in the financial markets. You have this choice between becoming an owner, which is what you do when you buy stocks, or you can essentially rent out your money in return for interest, which is what happens when you put your money into a certificate of deposit or a savings account or a bond. In each of these situations, whether it's buying a house or buying a car or buying pieces of corporations by purchasing stocks, you're going to do better financially by being an owner. Mm. But, and this is the big caveat, you only want to become an owner if you have a reasonably long time horizon. So for a car, you got to really cease owning that car for 3 or 4 years. For the house, you want to stay put for 5 to 7 years. And with the stock market, I would say you need at least a 10-year time horizon. That means sort of 5 or 6 years to make good money and then a couple of years to look for the exit.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you could spend some time with us. Controversy has broken out in New England between publishers, Old Farmer's Almanac, and the other publication known simply as Farmer's Almanac, are predicting two different types of winter this year. One says mild, the other says teeth-chattering cold. Which one are we supposed to believe? Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Levitz. Jennifer, what's going on here?
Everyone wants to know what the winter's going to do, and there are two almanacs, which many people may not realize. There's two almanacs. One of them is from 1792. One of them started in 1818. Two farmers' almanacs, and they have dueling weather predictions this year.
How do they come up with dueling weather predictions, especially when they're so far out?
They have very kind of closely guarded ways of figuring out the weather. You know, they just have different ways of doing it. And they, like you said, they do it very far out. The Farmer's Almanac, says it does its forecast 2 years ahead of its release using a secret mathematical formula applied to sunspot activity, planet positions, and the moon's effect on the Earth.
Wow.
The Old Farmer's Almanac formula is based on solar activity, astronomy cycles, and historical weather conditions. So they are kind of complicated formulas that have been around a long time, and they don't always come out the same, but it's very unusual for them to be such polar opposites.
How accurate are they about these weather predictions?
They claim about 80% accuracy rate. Meteorologists say it's much less than that. People who've studied that, they say that it's more like you know, the groundhog or something. They say it's impossible to say what the weather and snowfall and weekly conditions are going to be 18 months, 2 years out. And they say that the almanacs kind of grade themselves generously, so it's hard to say exactly how they did. But then you have people who are faithful to them who say they've been very accurate for their region that they've come through, and there's people who you consult them to plan weddings and to plant. And so they really do have a following, but they are definitely not, meteorologists are not fans.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Levitz about her piece entitled, "Will It Be Cold This Winter? It Depends Which Farmer's Almanac You Read." That's because the Old Farmer's Almanac and the Farmer's Almanac have dueling winter forecasts this year. These things also dispense other advice, right? They're not just consulted for weather.
That's right. Yeah, one of the interesting things is that a lot of people who read these, they also look at nature a lot, and they have a lot of, they can tell you all kinds of signs that might indicate a bad weather or a mild winter. They'll look at, you know, number of squirrels you see, acorns in the yard. So these almanacs also will talk a lot about that kind of thing, and they'll give all sorts of life advice. So they're fun to read in that respect. You know, the uses for things that you never thought of, you know, wood ash and household uses for peanut butter, or, you know, small space planting.
Thanks, Jennifer. Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Levitz. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. It's good work if you can get it. A historic lighthouse turned bed and breakfast situated on an island in the Bay Area will pay $130,000 a year for new innkeepers. The San Francisco Chronicle says in the middle of the San Pablo Bay sits East Brother Light Station, built in 1874 on a small island just north of the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge. It now operates as an inn, and after April, there will be nobody to run it. The current operators will be handing over the keys. Applicants should be prepared to do everything it takes to keep the place running, including ferrying guests to the 0.7-acre outpost on the water. A press release said, quote, the successful candidates will be a couple, one of whom must possess a Coast Guard commercial boat operator's license. They will operate the 5-room inn, serving both dinner and breakfast, as well as providing ferry service for guests and all other tasks from chef to maid. High-quality culinary experience and capability will be a critical qualification. The inn, by the way, is open 4 days a week, and the island is also available for day use and special events. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.